This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome to the 29th Annual Writers' Symposium by the Sea, a bonus edition at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson. I'm the journalism faculty at the school, and it's a pleasure to have Amor Towles with us talking about his new book, Table for Two.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, that was wild. That was wild enough. That was good. So, other books, Rules of Civility, Gentleman in Moscow, Lincoln Highway, all bestsellers. So we're so glad you're here. So this book was such a pleasure to read. Table for Two, it's a collection of short stories and a novella. I thought it was an amazing book, but I was reading in your introduction that you said it was only after you had written the stories that you saw that there was a thread of something in common.
Yes.
Among them. What was in common?
So what Dean's referring to is that the stories were all written in the course of the last 10 years, roughly. And I had brought them together and had ordered them and been revising them and everything, and I was ready to send the manuscript into my publisher, and at that point, the collection didn't have a title. And you sort of have to picture that at that point, what's been happening is in the previous 90 days, I've read through the manuscript, you know, 8 times. You know, you're reading over and over and over from beginning to end in the final round of editing this sort of initial draft, or the first submitted big draft. And I had just read two stories back to back that are in the middle of the collection, as it were, I Will Survive and The Bootlegger. And in each of these stories, there's a point at which two characters find themselves across a kitchen table in conversation. And in one, it's a mother and daughter. In the other, it's a sort of a Wall Street type, a younger Wall Street type who's met an old man by chance, and they're sitting across from each other. And in both cases, the conversation is really about some small thing that has happened which has potentially big ramifications for their lives. And so the conversation is material. And so I was sort of like, oh, that's interesting that these two stories that, you know, I had written within a couple of years of each other both have this sort of moment embedded in them. And then I was like, I went back and went to the beginning, and I went through all the stories, and it turned out it was in all of the stories. There was always this moment where sort of two people find themselves across from each other. I think it's in every story but one. And I was like, oh, that's, so somewhere in my subconscious, as I was writing these stories, I must have been interested in or wrestling with this notion of how the small thing with bigger ramifications ultimately has to be sort of dealt with by two people, whether they're strangers or siblings or, you know, a father or parent child or husband and wife, whatever it is. Because if you don't have that conversation, of course, everything could go awry, you know, in their lives. And so it must have been a subconscious thing, and it kept showing up. And so that's how the title of the book became Table for Two.
The short stories are primarily based in New York, and then you've got the novella. That's the last half of this book that is based in Los Angeles.
Right.
So the conversations, though, in each of these short stories, the first half of the book, are just so they're just so compelling. So the first story, you've got a story about a guy who spends most of his time standing in line.
Yeah.
So that right there
is
interesting. He spends part of that time standing in line in a communist country, and part of his time standing in line in a capitalist country.
Yes, right.
That's the story.
Yeah.
And it was awesome.
Sounds great, right, everybody?
No, it was. It was beautifully done, and I mean that it's the same thing throughout. So the second one, this is the one that really maybe drew me the most. It's a story about a frustrated writer. Gee. I wonder what that could be about. So you write, he had a fear so dark and disturbing that it could barely be acknowledged, the fear that he had no story to tell.
Right.
So this is a story about a guy who wants to write, and he moves to New York because that's what people, that's what you did.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
And he moves to New York, but his greatest inconveniences in this story had been mowing lawns, raking leaves, shoveling snow. He'd never been an alcoholic or been divorced. What could he possibly write about?
Yes. And what I think what the narrator of that story says is his parents didn't even have, they weren't even willing to get divorced or be alcoholics for his benefit, you know?
Yeah, yeah, just help the guy out.
Yeah, give him something to write about.
Yeah, exactly. So, yes. But this is actually leading up to a question. I'm continuing here. It says, he dreamed of fame, but he had nothing to say.
Yeah.
So has that ever been a problem for you? Where you've aspired to be a writer most of your life. I mean, you were writing when you were a little kid. But did you ever get to a point where you just thought, you know, I don't have anything to say now?
No. No.
I didn't think so. Based on what I've read, I didn't think so.
You know, I think the picture of, and this person, the character in the story is about 25 years old. And I think that's a very natural thing for many young writers to be grappling with, which is, you know, what has happened in my life that is worth covering? What do I know about the world, and do I have something that is important to say? And I think that for the most part, I've always tried to keep my focus on telling a story without worrying about what it might mean to others. Because for me, some people really write towards having a message. And for me, it's always been, when someone says, what is your book about? If I could say to them what my book was about in a few sentences, that book would be a failure, for sure, you know? And so, because for me, the fiction, but let's say that use the example of a novel for a second. For me, I often will think of a novel as a machine for meaning. That the goal of a finely made novel is that you have to picture that a novel is a composition of thousands of elements of craft. So within it are conversations and settings and personalities and backgrounds and memories and philosophical observations and debates and the poetry of the language and metaphors and similes and allusions and allegories. That's all packed in there. And in a finely written novel, this wide array of elements feels somehow inappropriate, like it's very diverse, but yet feels like it's all there, belongs there. But what it means, what it allows for, is that many different readers from different walks of life, men, women, old, young, rich, poor, different religions, whatever, can come to a well-written narrative, enjoy it in a similar fashion, but they could each walk away with a very different impression of what it means to them. You know, because it's the way that they're assembling the various elements in their mind and the connections that they're drawing, the emotions that have been stirred up for them, and partly because of their own memories and their own observations, their own relationships that become a filter for that. And the end result is that they may have, as I say, very different understandings of what this book could mean. And so that's the big ambition for me, right? Someone having grown up reading literature is to create something that could achieve that goal. And so to me, the enemy of that is by starting out and saying, what's this book going to be about? You know, and or what's the major theme? What is it going to mean? And so I really don't do that. What I do instead is I focus on what is the story that has come to me, what events happen, who are the people, what occurs, and then to try to write it as best as I possibly can and just assume that later on someone else is going to figure out what it means. Because I don't know.
Yeah, that's the reader's job, I suppose.
That's the reader's job.
So let me just give quick summaries about some of these other short stories in this collection. There's a short story about a guy who befriends a stranger at an airport, yep. Which was just a harrowing story. That got more and more intense. There's a story about a stepfather leading a double life, and the truth ruined everything. Yep. There's a story about a guy who secretly records concerts, yep. And the truth ruins everything. There's a story about selling an art fragment and family dynamics in there. There were so many lines, so many memorable characters. Do you have, is one of those like a favorite of yours?
No, I don't.
You like all your children equally?
Yeah, I do like all my children. I think that to some degree you have to, even in a novel with a large ensemble of characters like the Lincoln Highway or General in Moscow, to ultimately do a good job of writing the story and bringing the characters to life, you do have to fall in love with all of them one at a time. And, one of the interesting things, I guess as an aside, is that for me often the biggest, in a novel, the biggest difference between draft one and draft two is that in draft two, I tend to be shrinking the amount of words that are dedicated to, say, the three or four central characters. And I tend to be adding space for characters 5, 6, 7, and 8. And you can't, this is sort of makes sense if you think about, like, you're, when you're writing the book, you're going to overwrite the main characters, because it's so important to sort of have them fully imagined and have their events fully described, to have their emotional lives and their ideas shared with the reader, but you end up overdoing it. You know, the reader doesn't need to know all of that, and you've over-explained it like I'm doing now. And so in the part of the editing process, to take the same amount of emotional, intellectual material, the same vibrancy of those characters, but reducing the amount of language that you're using to describe those events and those experiences. And here's sort of a paradox of writing, which is that as you shrink it and taking away excess words and sentences and explanations, you're actually increasing the vitality of the character. You know, the characters can get killed by the overbearing descriptions that a writer can bring to the story. So that's happening in the editing process. I'm shrinking them down, providing better economy, making them sharper in a way, the central characters. But simultaneously, you have this sort of, as I'm rereading, I'm like, oh man, this is a great character who I have not done justice to. We have not heard enough from them. I did not draw them as accurately and in as much detail as they deserve. And so suddenly in the rethinking and the revision, those characters start to express themselves. They suddenly are in the conversation that they had been left out of to make their point of view, or that, you know, they have a chapter suddenly dedicated to something that how they're processing whatever the events are. And so that's sort of this long way of saying it, you have to kind of keep falling in love with each of these individual characters, really with the goal of bringing them fully to life.
But the short story is taking even a bigger axe,
yes,
to all of that. And
yes.
Do you prefer one method over another? Are you now that you have this new collection of short stories, are you thinking, I want to hang here for a while?
Well, I mean, I've written short stories since I was a kid, and I think most novelists, we kind of grow up writing short stories at whatever age you start, because the short story is the best form in which to master elements of craft. And you do that by writing all kinds of different stories with a different approach to setting, or a different approach to characterization, a different approach to dialogue, a different tone for the narrators. And so you just keep experimenting in different stories with different topics, set in different places, about different people, but telling them in different ways, and slowly but surely what happens is mastery of craft, you hope. And so that's where you come from. But now, in writing these, I think one of the things that really stood out for me in reflecting, having, you know, just spent 15 years writing three novels and then sort of doing these stories, reflecting on the difference, so let me take it one step back to say that when I was in high school, the teacher who had the greatest influence on me probably was a guy named Dick Baker. He was a great intellect, very rigorous English and literature classes. He taught us all how to read carefully, how to interpret text, read with a pen. He taught us how to write our analytical thoughts about the literature that we were reading, and he would mark up our essays, you know, quite actively and, you know, hand them back. And when I would get my essays back, the most common comment that he would have in the margin was the initials S-U-G. And S-U-G stood for sweeping unsupported generality. Yeah. And he meant that as a criticism. You know? Now, as it turned out, it was kind of my superpower, so it all worked out in the end.
But, so you developed even further.
Yeah, just kept going. Take it another step further. So I'm going to share with you a sweeping unsupported generality right now, and the sweeping unsupported generality is that in terms of looking at the difference between the novel and the short story, is that one major difference is that the novel, in writing a novel, an author consciously or unconsciously, is very concerned with orientation. So, as you enter the world of a novel, the writer, consciously or unconsciously, has to orient you in that world by establishing when is this taking place, where is it taking place, who are these people, what is their relationship to each other, what class do they come from, what are some of the events in the recent past that have bearing on where we're going, who are the critical players, and some, maybe even some glimpse of some of the themes that are going to play a big role later in the novel. And this is a very important part of novel writing, providing this sense of orientation. And if you go back and take your favorite novels and read the first 15 pages, I think you'll be amazed, if you think about it this way, of how much information is there. Now that you've read the whole thing, you go back and look at it and say, oh yeah, there's so much there to get me started. Because we as readers need that orientation in order to go into the adventure of the novel with confidence and with it, so that we have an awareness to then follow the tale in a way that is meaningful. Well, in a short story, you do not have this. You do not have the time to lay that out. And so the job of the writer and the reader changes radically. You're not going to be about orientation. So instead, it's kind of about disorientation. You start right in the middle of things, and you're trying to figure out, okay, wait, what's just happened? Why is he? Who are they? And why is he mad at her? And wait, what year is this? And and you're kind of, as you're reading the page, you're piecing it together. Even you're aware that you're running out of space already. The thing's going to be over 4 pages from now. And you're still figuring out the layout. And that I think that's an exciting thing to write in that form. In its way, and it's a very satisfying and exciting thing to read in once you sort of get that taste for it, that I'm not going to get set up, I'm not going to have everything explained to me, I'm going to be dropped into something, I'm going to have to figure out where I am, and it's not going to be a long evolution of thematic material which culminates page 400. Instead, it's going to be a glimpse of a life, a moment in time, which may have great bearing on the lives beyond the pages of the story, and that we can have quite a deep response to the story, even though it is only a glimpse of life. I think it's the story provides a different kind of satisfaction, but a great one.
Well, you mentioned writing stories short stories since you were a kid. What were you writing about? Shoveling snow and raking leaves?
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Let's see.
Mowing lawns?
Probably. Wishing that I'd been arrested or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you remember any of those stories topics at least?
So what happened is, for me, I decided I want to be a writer in first grade because my...
Wait. You decided you wanted to be a writer in first grade?
Yes. I'm going to tell you the story. But yes. So
keep going.
What happened is my first grade teacher, Mrs. Gom, was friends with a rather well-known regional poet, a juvenile poet, meaning he wrote poetry for the young, named David McCord. He'd written many books and was quite well-known, as I say, in the New England area and beyond. And so he came to our class, and he read his poetry from different books, and then he signed books and gave them to us at the end of class, and I just remember being like, I just thought everything about it was great. Like, I loved hearing his poetry, which I loved the wordplay, the sort of the rhyming schemes, the surprising endings of the poems. I loved hearing him read them sort of as an audience member, and I loved the effect it was having on us as a group of young, kids. I loved having the book to bring home. I thought that was really cool. And so that night, the next night, roughly, I began writing poetry like him, trying to match what he was doing. And then that was just the beginning. So from there, you keep reading, and so I would read something, and then I would explore in writing some version of something that I had fallen in love with. Ray Bradbury, who you and I were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. was a hero of mine when I was probably 10, 11, you know. And then you discover Agatha Christie and Ian Fleming's James Bond, and I would read a whole bunch of them and sort of go down that road. And but then you get, you know, you're 17 or 18, and then suddenly you're being introduced to literature. And, you know, so novels that, like the ones that I described earlier, that have the capacity to touch us in all these incredible ways, to be meaningful 300 years after they were written in another country. You know, it's a crazy kind of thing when you think about it. And to be stimulating and at the same time. You know, when you sort of experience novels like that as a young student, that's where you, as I was beginning, you start to say, okay, now I get it. Now I get what this can be. But this thing I've always liked writing, it can be this. And then you're really in it.
Well, and to take that further, I mean, you were taught by one of the greats, Peter Matheson, when you were at Yale.
Yes.
So, who was here, part of the Writers' Symposium in 2005. So, I just can't imagine being under the influence of that guy in your writing. So, he had to have changed your trajectory even further, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And I'm going to have to apologize. This is a little bit of a longer story, but you have to kind of hear each element to come.
We've got all night.
Okay. I'll pay for your parking, whatever. But, but so what happened is I was at Yale, and I had been writing all along in high school, and I was already been writing at Yale. I think I was a junior. He came to spend a semester on campus to teach a writing seminar. I applied. I got in. And you were welcome to submit, invited to submit stories every week, in which I did. And at the end of the third week, as the class was breaking up, he said, hey, listen, can you stick around for a minute? So everybody left and I stayed. And he said, listen, Amor, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you want. I don't know why you're here. But on the basis of the three stories I've read, I think that you may be gifted at this. And so I'm going to take my time with you very seriously. And I hope that you're going to take your time with me very seriously, too. And that was a very important moment for me in my life, as you might imagine, because the when you're a teenager, as an artist, whatever your field, you have these two sides of you. On the one hand, you're like, I think I can really do this thing that I love, whether it's whatever, your music or whatever it is. But in writing, I think I can do this. I would compare myself to my peers who are writing, but then I compare myself to books that I admired, and I'd be like, yeah, there's something about this, I think I can do this. So that's half of you, and the other half of you is like, you're out of your mind, Amor. Like, why would you think that, you know, that you can do this? And so there's no proof of that. And so, and your mother can't give it to you, you know? Mom gave me lots of things, but she can't, you know, saying, oh, this is such a beautiful story. That doesn't matter, you know, that she thinks that. So this is the point where you first have an outside person who is talented in your craft, whom you admire, who singles you out to give this message, and it has, you know, changed my life. And then what happens, though? There's a part two to this story. So I kept working with Peter, and he became, you know, my mentor and a friend. But when I was 25 and I had moved to New York City to write novels, I was living in an illegal sublet with a friend. I was a little frustrated and claustrophobic and bored and broke. And so I joined a friend of mine who had started an investment firm. It was just the two of us at first. And, you know, 20 years later, we were still working side by side. And for the first 10 years, I did not write fiction as we were building the firm. And I would see Peter. We'd have, you know, lunch or dinner, you know, maybe twice a year. And every time, he was very upset. And rightfully so, because he really felt like, I gave you this time.
And once you're out,
yeah,
you know, do yeah. you ever really get you, back
yeah.
to it?
Yeah, so, and what he said, he would say, how's your book coming? And he could tell by my response that I wasn't making progress, and it just broke his heart. And so finally, after a couple of years of this, maybe 5 years of this, at the end of dinner, he says, Amor, I want to tell you something. And maybe he's, you know, approaching 70 at this point. He says, Amor, I've now seen multiple generations come and go through the arts, and, you know, starting with my own. And what I can tell you is that in the course of seeing those generations, that there's something about working on Wall Street that it is so interesting. It's interesting enough. It's the people are interesting enough. It's challenging enough. It pays well enough. That my experience now is that when an artist goes to Wall Street, they never come back. And so I think that you should consider your life as a writer over.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So that was the end of dinner. I was like, no dessert for me, thanks. And so, but well, anyways.
Did you take that seriously? Did you think?
Yeah, no. Yeah, it was very, because he was right. On that day, I was not writing. And so now, so here's an odd thing about, at least for me, but I think this is true for many artists, is that I love it. I love it more than anything in the world, you know, with the exception of my wife and children. But I love it more than anything in the world. And that, as it turned out, wasn't enough. Like, loving it wasn't enough to get me to do it every day. And what ended up really turning me back on to flipping the switch was dread. It was the dread of waking up at the age of 60 or whatever and having failed to fulfill, you know, fulfill the promise of this talent which Peter had observed, and to some degree letting him down, you know, being able to look back. So I then began writing on the weekends, and I spent 7 years writing a novel I didn't like and set that aside, but I learned a lot from that experience, and then I wrote Rules of Civility, and that became a bestseller, and I retired from the firm. And God bless, Peter was still alive at the time, because it would have been very sad for me if he had not... he had not lived to witness that I did come around and ultimately fulfill his confidence in me.
So when you were writing Rules of Civility, were you thinking that you were writing this kind of for Peter?
No. And in fact, actually, that's an interesting side note. I was really doing it for myself, and because it's what I really wanted to do. But one funny thing is that because Peter gave me these gifts, right? So he recognized my talent. He kind of lit the fire under me when I was drifting away from my purpose as a writer. But so then he gave me a third gift. And the third gift was that I finished Rules of Civility, and I called him up and I said, hey, listen, he knew I had written this 7-year book and it failed, and I said, I've taken another crack at it. It's a totally different book. I think it's really great. And I'd love to hear your take. And he said, great, send it to me. Sends it back to me. And he's like, Amor, it's not for me. I don't really get it. I don't know why you're writing a book set in 1938. And I don't like your heroine. You know, and I think she's too sassy and she kind of bugs me. And and I'm sorry. And so he really kind of panned the book for me. And as I say, this was the third gift, you know, because it was very upsetting receiving the letter. But then you kind of retreat from it, and I would go back and look at the book and say, you know what? I think he's wrong. You know, I think it's really a good book. And then you, got an agent. It ended up being sold at auction, and you start to gain, sure. and it all worked out. And then he sent me a beautiful note saying, you know, dear Amor, this is my eating crow letter, you know?
Awesome.
And I say that's a really an important gift, this, because, and which it was an unintentional gift on his part. I mean, it was intentional that it was honest, but is that having your mentor not like what you're doing is a very valuable thing to go through. You know, because at the end of the day, you've got to really carry that water yourself. You know, you have to have faith in yourself, understand your own work, you know, advocate for your own work, know how to edit your own work, know how to be confident at when the critical moment comes. And so having his negative response at that moment helped me kind of build that muscle, as it were.
Well, the other dimension of what I think is so interesting about his influence on you is he wrote about the environment. He wrote about animals. He wrote about birds and climate and indigenous people. You don't write about that. I think is so interesting.
Yeah. Well, he had two lives, right? Because he's a very famous naturalist and essayist because of the snow leopard and many books of that kind. But he also wrote... many novels and very important ones. Although his Killing Mr. Watson trilogy ended up winning the National Book Award as a 3-novel combined book. His Far Tortuga is amazing. At Play in the Fields of the Lord is great. So he was a very unusual writer in that he had, I think he'd reached, he might have won the National Book Award both as a nonfiction writer and a fiction writer, which is very unusual. So fiction was his first love.
Okay. Well, let's get back to you.
Okay, yeah.
All right, yeah. That's right. This book that you wrote that you didn't think was very good, are we ever going to see
it? We're going to go there?
yeah. Are we ever going to see it?
No, you'll never see that. You'll never see that.
What was wrong with it?
What was wrong? Well, the best way to describe what was flawed in that book is by talking about how I approached Rules of Civility differently. And the single most important difference in the two works was that I had not outlined that failed book. And I think, you know, those of you who've read my work probably have a sense of this, which is that I'm very interested in how a novel as an art form can be very cohesive, where it has all these elements which are sort of building and then coming together at the end in some sort of culmination of events that feels all sort of fated and predestined, and where the imagery has sort of played out over the course of the novel, and the thematics have built, and the nuances have played with each other, and et cetera. And to have this sort of in the way that a symphony, I like to think of it in that way, that a novel can be like a symphony, and that a Mozart symphony, a Beethoven symphony, you've got different parts of the symphony, different passages of it, different movements, I guess the musical term, but you might have a motifs that repeat. You may have a particular type of phrase of music which repeats, but is interpreted by different instruments. You know, here by an oboe alone, then suddenly by the entire string section, and then played for a different mood, at a different tempo, at a different volume over the course of the symphony. But then you get to the end of the symphony, it all kind of comes together in this great sort of culmination, and when they hit the final chord, we as in the audience are like, oh, that was it, that's perfect, you know? And so I like to achieve that in the novel. That's what my aim is, at any rate, and you cannot really do that if you don't outline. Because to try to bring everything together in this cohesive way without planning, it's just going to be impossible. And so that unplanned book, I could look back at it and say, oh, at the end of it, now I kind of understand all the elements that I would wish were coming together now, but it would require going back and writing the whole thing from word one.
Well, you know, you mentioned outline. You are a real stickler with outline. In fact,
yes.
You spend a lot of time on outline.
Yes.
So let me see if I understand how what your process is. First, you get an idea, and you sit with that idea for a couple of days, and then you start to create an outline. Scaffolding, I think, is what you called it.
Yeah.
But that could take years, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And then you write the novel.
Yes.
So is that how it works?
Yeah, so I'll expand on what you're saying, because it is true. Usually an idea for me for a story or a novel is very brief. It's a sentence. It might come to me because I see something. It might come from me out of ether. A guy gets trapped in a hotel for a long period of time. And that was literally the sentence that I started with. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea for a story. And then what will happen is, it was in a hotel in Geneva when I had that idea. I took the elevator upstairs, I checked into my room, and immediately took out the hotel stationery, because this will often happen with something that really grabs me, is within a matter of minutes, I'm like, I know a lot about it. So that man trapped in a hotel, I know a lot about it in that I was like, oh, this could be in Russia. It'll be an aristocrat, he could be sentenced to house arrest in a fancy hotel across the street from the Kremlin. It could start after the revolution and go all the way to the Cold War. And all that I knew about a gentleman in Moscow in the first few minutes. And then in the course of the 2 hours, I filled maybe 5 pages of handwritten notes, which was the scaffolding, which was basically all the key events of the story, like how it would play out. But then what happens is really grabs me is I will spend 2, 3, 4 years designing the book, is what I call it. And what I'll do is I'll take notebooks, and by hand, in a whole series of notebooks, I will imagine everything that happens, all the characters, their backgrounds, their personalities, the various events, the settings, some of the conversations, a lot of the tone, some of the philosophical components, just sort of working through the idea by hand.
This is all before the narrative begins.
Yeah. And what I may be experimenting with things that are going to be a part of the narrative, like the opening of a chapter or an actual scene. I may say, to try it out, see how it's going. But basically, it's this design phase. And I might do that 4 different ways, you know. And then at the end of that, then you actually, now I know everything. So then I make the outline, which is usually probably for a novel, might be 30 or 40 pages long. And then I start writing chapter 1. And then with a short story, it's the exact same thing, but just compressed. I still have an idea that might be a sentence. I then might dwell on it and start to design it and sort of imagine all the components, the people, the events. I'll build an outline, but the outline might be on a page. You know, and the design phase might be 3 months instead of 3 years.
So how close is the final product to the outline? Is it really close, or do you leave room for, oh, I think it needs to go this way?
There's enormous changes. The scaffolding parts, it tends to be very close. So I've always known the end of the book immediately, and that has never changed in any of the draftings. But when I say, for those who know A Gentleman in Moscow, let's say, like, Nina, day one idea was always there. He becomes a waiter. Day one idea, always there. His nemesis is going to be the bishop. You know, there'll be this guy from the KGB, Osip, and they'll become friends. And, you know, that was always there. And, you know, Anna Urbanova, that's always there. What's changing really is more, you know, those key things are there. What's changing is incidents are changing, or the characters, the personalities may be shifting as I'm getting a better sense of who they are. Certainly the poetry of the language is changing a lot as I'm taking different approaches to telling the story.
Okay. So let's talk about the second half of this book, Table for Two, the novella. You pick up a character from Rules of Civility, and we start to follow her now out to Los Angeles. And I just have to confess that while I was reading that, I became angry with you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Good, okay.
Yeah. Here's why.
Okay.
You made me late for several appointments.
Good, yeah, good.
I would be reading this and thinking, oh, no, the next chapter. Yeah. I can work that in before physical therapy. And
yeah.
And it never worked. There was this gravitational pull from one chapter to the next and it was so skillfully done. And then I read this, what the New York Times said about you. You said, beneath his coiffed prose, New York Times called, beneath his coiffed prose, Tolles is a master of the shiv, the bait and switch. We see the flash of light before the shockwave strikes, often in the final sentence. And that's exactly how that novella hit me, because I was thinking, okay, I'm going to wrap up, just this will resolve, and now I can go to my appointment. And it was such superbly crafted. I just got to tell you, I was impressed, but really, really angry.
Okay. Hey, one star.
yeah, that's going on my Yelp review. Exactly.
Good.
Oh my gosh. But you just, I mean, that is such a conscious thing on your part, clearly, to pull the reader from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next.
Yeah.
Visually, how are you seeing that when you're doing it?
It's an interesting question. I do think that fiction can benefit from having some kind of internal momentum. And you know, I don't mean it in the suspense story sense. Although it's a cousin to that, but you know, a novel feeling the compelling need to go further and further into the story is that's a valuable thing if you could figure out how to do it, but a lot of the time it tends to be around I'm not even sure I know what it is, but it's constantly following the thread of human development, you know, I think is a part of it, right? You know, is that as something is happening, people are changing, and sort of getting a glimpse of the fact that they're changing, you can see the stakes are changing and the person's changing and what they were going to do next is suddenly up for grabs, you know, because of what's just happened, and they might now say something totally different to their spouse than they would have said the night before, and you know, anything can happen. So, but you can have all kinds of urgency in narrative and domestic or, you know, or international. But
I just felt like I was under this gravitational pull in that novella. And I just thought, oh man, props to you.
Thank you.
It was beautiful, beautiful. So you've talked a lot about craft and how much attention you pay to it. You've compared your writing craft to Andre Agassi's tennis.
Yeah.
So how are these two things similar?
Well, what Dean is referencing is, and it's not so much that I'm comparing myself to Agassi, but it's that It's about mastery of craft, trying to explain how the mastery of craft works in writing, and I would do it by analogy. It's like Andre Agassi, and what I mean by it is that Andre Agassi does not have a great forehand. What Andre Agassi has is 100 great forehands. Because over the course of his young career, what he's doing is he is trying to master certainly how to return a high-speed serve with topspin over down across the center of the net. But he's also trying to master how to do a soft shot when he's approaching a net from mid-court, when he's reeling back on his feet from the baseline into a lob, doing a short cut. And they think wherever he is on the court, wherever the ball is coming, wherever he needs to send it, that is a different forehand, and each one needs to be mastered. And he wants to get to the point where he doesn't have to think about it. Instinctively, when he's in that spot, the ball's coming in that direction, the player, his opponent there, he is going to do the perfect swing to send the ball where it needs to go to master, to win the point, right? Well, writing is very much like this in the sense that ability in dialogue, in setting, in characterization, in using metaphor and using allegory or allusion, there is not one of any of these things, right? No, there's a writer, you don't go and master one of these things with one approach. Instead, what you need to do is master each of those elements in all kinds of contexts. Because when you shift what a story is from an aristocrat in Russia in 1920 to a bunch of 18-year-olds in America in 1954, everything has to change. The way that the plot unfolds, the way the dialogue unfolds, the way that setting is described, the way that metaphors are used or not used, the way that allusions are done or not done, the poetry throughout the language, all that has to be different to fit with these characters in this context at this time. Now, in the case of the Lincoln Highway, it gets more complicated because you have 8 different characters who are telling the story from 8 different perspectives, and each one of those has to sound differently to the reader, and should, because it has to be an expression of the inner life of Sally or Wooly or Duchess, depending on whose chapter it is. And so each time you make that shift, all the elements of craft in a way have to readjust to be an expression of that character's internal life. And then again, that's one of those things, again, that gets you that pull of going on, because you really feel like, okay, I'm with this person, seeing the world through their eyes, and what's happening from their angle, end of chapter, and I'm going to have to now revisit all of that in through, Emmett's eyes to see what he thinks or what he feels or what might happen to him, under these circumstances. So anyway, so that's the tennis metaphor is really about that.
Well, and it's remarkable, all the different shots that you've mastered, because I'm thinking you cover in Gentleman in Moscow, that's a 32-year period in that book. Lincoln Highway is 10 days.
Yes, and that's a very different type of writing. There's a lot of differences between those two books, but the biggest difference is the one of duration. And the reason that's such a big difference is that, from a writing standpoint, is that when you write a book that spans 30 years, like John Moscow, it is going to be significantly about evolution, right? Because what's happening over 30 years is that the main character, the Count, is going through changes, and he's evolving as an individual. The relationships are evolving, him and the actress, or him and Nina, or he and the people in the kitchen. That's evolving. Russia is evolving, right? So when you read a story like that that spans 30 years, almost certainly the evolution of all kinds of these elements are going to be a central aspect of the story in terms of how it's told and in terms of the thematic impact, the emotional impact for the reader. When you shift to a story of the Lincoln Highway that only has 10 days, you don't have the luxury of describing evolution in that fashion. So what I have to do in that case is figure out, how am I going to take this narrow aperture of human experience, this brief moment of time, and give glimpses of the past and a sense of the future in such a way that the reader still feels like, even though they only read 10 days, that they still somehow took in the totality of life, not simply just a moment in time. And that's a different kind of challenge from a writing standpoint.
Well, and then you compress it even further in this novella, because that's down to a couple of days.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
But you're seeing it through all these different characters'
eyes. That's correct.
a remarkable thing you're able to do. So let me give you a line from the novella that has to do with money. And it says, like the wind that spins a windmill, money comes out of nowhere, sets the machinery in motion, then disappears without a trace. And I'm thinking, that's the former investment banker speaking there, isn't it?
Well, the person who says this is an immoral individual in the story. So, but I don't know. Yeah, maybe my Wall Street life. Yeah, prepares me to think of money that way. Yeah.
So, was it a little weird to be writing about the entertainment industry? I realize it was like 1938 or something like that, while the entertainment industry is making a movie out of one of your books? Was that just a little kind of paradoxical for you?
I guess it was sort of a coincidence, I guess. It's very pleasant. I mean, yes, as I'm sure most of you, or maybe you don't, but many of you know, A Gentleman in Moscow is an 8-hour series starring Ewan McGregor, and it began airing 3 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, I'll tell you this about it, which is that you're very lucky to have, obviously, a novel that somebody say, we want to make it into a movie. That's really great. I'm principally interested in who's in this room. You know, I write books for readers. You know, the idea that it's going to be a movie is fun, but, you know, I'm principally interested in the readers rather than the viewers. But nonetheless, but it's still exciting, and you're lucky to have it happen. But I'm friends with Michael Lewis, who wrote, you know, Moneyball and The Blind Side and The Big Short. So he's had a lot of experience in seeing his work translated into the screen. And we were having lunch about a year and a half ago, and he says, hey, Amor, how's the Gentleman Moscow project going, you know, at that point? And I had just received the drafts for the first three episodes. So I told him that, and I said, they've asked me for my feedback, but I think they might just be being polite. And there's a pause, and Michael says, Amor, they are definitely just being polite. And not only do they not want to know what you think, they wish you were dead. That's true. He said that. Now,
check, please.
Yeah, exactly. I made him pay, I think. It didn't turn out to be that bad. I mean, I was invited into in early stages in a great way. I was involved in interviewing the directors and hiring the directors. I was involved in interviewing the head writer. I was involved in casting Ewan. And in each of those cases, there really was an opportunity for me to talk to them about why do they want to be a part of this project? What would they do with the book? What do they think is important? And the team, which is really paramount, said, you know, listen, Amor, have those conversations, and if you don't like the person or you think they're going in the wrong direction, we won't hire them, we move on. And so, you know, but listen, if we're going to give you that opportunity, then at the end of this process, when you've actually been involved in hiring these people and you know their vision and you feel comfortable with them, then we ask you to step back and let everybody do the job that they're trained for. Which was, you know, I think exactly the right attitude. Then it was sort of nice in that the head writer, the head director, each reached out to me in advance to say, listen, but I'm about to begin working, and I want to interview you about the book, about what you think it means, about what do you think are the important parts, about what's not in the book that you think would be instructive for me, whether about Russian history or the hotel or the count. And so I did that with the director, I did that with the writer, and then Ewan reached out, and he wanted to do that before he began performing the role, just so that he could make sure that he has as much information as possible to invent the character. And it is, I think they've done, of course there's differences, I've seen 4 of the 8 hours, and it's terrific. It's beautiful, Ewan McGregor's amazing. Of course, thank you. Of course, there's been changes. I was sitting with my wife. We were watching maybe episode 4, I think, or something. And what happens is when there's a scene, and it's like exactly as in the book, word for word, I'm like, oh, that's very good. That's good. You know, That's a great scene, you know?
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, it's really very good. And so then we're watching, and there's a scene in this episode where the Count is with his childhood friend Mishka, and it's an emotional scene, and they're talking about something that's gone wrong and reliving it, and it's not exactly what's in the book, and so I'm feeling a little bit, you know, it's irritating me a little bit. And so, you know, they're getting deeper into it. So I'm turning to my wife to express my moderate irritation, and she's crying. You know. She's weeping. I'm like, sweetie, I that's not in the book. I didn't write that. And she goes, I know, but it's so beautiful. So you know, it's not going to be exactly like the book, but you know, sometimes they do a good job. You know, they sometimes add an element which, you know, pleases my wife. So, you know.
Yeah. Props to them. So we're gonna start pulling this ship into the harbor here. But okay. I have to ask you about. This is my favorite line in the novella, and it's toward the end where the Charlie character says, if we don't stare down the thing that makes us want to look away, then the world is just a mirage.
Yeah.
I want to know, is that true in writing for you, that's the thing you have to write about, is the thing that you would rather just look away from?
I probably don't do that enough. It's a very interesting question, because I'm not a writer who is like, for instance, saying, what are the worst things what are the challenges that we face as a society right now? What's going on politically? What's going on, you know, as we tackle issues of race or gender or generationally or, you know, right wing, left wing? I am absolutely not that person, that writer. So it's so funny that Charlie says that, because he's probably right. But, you know, so for me, it has to be kind of a different version of that, which is that it has to be the willingness to look at the way humans behave and interact, and to look at them very closely and with generosity. You know, so that you can see, because we all have our limitations and we all have our strengths. And I think to bring characters to life accurately, you really have to embrace the variety of human experience and the variety of human personalities and kind of give them each their due. And that's the thing that I think, you know, I really try to focus on trying to achieve.
Yeah. So you've given us a lot to think about regarding craft and all, but there's a lot of people who will be watching this and even who are here tonight who are writers, and they just want, give me just some advice.
Yeah.
Give me some writing advice. Have you got some?
Yeah, it's really annoyingly pithy, but it's really the only advice I can offer, which is because it's what my experience was, which was read, write, repeat. That's it, you know. Is that we as writers educate ourselves by reading all different kinds of storytelling and seeing and being amazed by what Marquez is doing in magical realism, to see what Whitman and Melville were doing as they were inventing the American discourse sort of from nothing. I mean, they're using the traditional English, but it's really unique. There's nothing in the English tradition that is quite like Whitman or Melville. And so they really are inventing that out of the American discourse. And to go back, you know, to read, you know, the Deep South writers or the, you know, what each with the beat guys and the French writers of the Second World War era, because they were, you know, they're all crazy. You know, there's no plots. The characters don't have names. You know, you can't make head nor tails of it. But I love it, you know, because it's just a different way to tell a story. And so I think that's the mission. You just keep going on a hungry basis, reading through different approaches to storytelling, and then forcing yourself to try your hand at not copying necessarily, but being open to trying to tell different stories in different ways as often as possible to, you know, master your craft. Now, you've been very patient. Before I let you go, I do want to share one other thing and then you can all run for the doors or whatever. But and that is, I wanted to give you a sense of, because it comes up, is my sense of the role that history plays in my work. And the best way for me to do this is through analogy. So what I want you to imagine is that you're in a theater, and that you're a theater to see a play. Let's say it's Chekhov. Let's say it's The Cherry Orchard. Now, what you're looking at on stage is the set is a wealthy country estate in late 19th century Russia. And there's, you know, sort of beautiful furniture and what have you. At the back of the stage are a pair of French doors. through the French doors, you can see the cherry orchard in the distance. It's afternoon, that's spring, so the cherry blossoms, the cherry is in bloom, the cherry trees are in bloom, you can see the white and pink blossoms. Now, of course, when you're looking at that, the cherry blossoms through the French door, French doors, what you're actually looking at is painted canvas. Because that's in a stage play, that's how we do that, right? We take canvas, we paint the illusion of a cherry orchard, and we hang that behind the glass of the doors. Now, when the crew paints the cherry orchard, they are not going to do that in a hyper-realist style. They're going to do it in an impressionist style, the way that Renoir or Manet would paint it. Because a hyper-realist style would look weird to the eye. At that distance, the impressionist style looks right. It's a little fuzzy, but in addition, it has that quality that impressionism has of having a little bit of movement to it. So you can almost see the blossoms shifting in the breeze in the afternoon light, right? Now, in front of that, on either side of the French doors, are plywood bookcases that have been painted to look like mahogany. And over here, there's a door that goes nowhere, and here is a staircase that goes up to nothing, right? This is a part of the set. But in the middle of the stage is an actual dining room table surrounded by actual dining room chairs. And on the table is an actual china tea service. And it's very important that these things be real. Because that's a picture that in this scene, there's a young woman sitting at the table having tea by herself. The door slams and her brother storms in. He's obviously clearly upset about something. When he sits down, we want to hear the wooden legs of the chair scrape against the wooden surface of the table as he pulls himself up sort of to the table in high emotion. And when he starts to talk to his sister and he suddenly hits the table for emphasis, we want to hear the physicality of his hand hitting the wooden surface of the table. And when she, who has been listening very patiently, sets down her teacup, we want to hear that gentle clink of the porcelain hitting the porcelain. Now, it's very important in the theater that these things be real because the sharpness of those impressions help us sort of bring into focus this moment that the actors are having. Now, my work is structured in the exact same way. So for me, history is the painted backdrop, all right? And for me, I'm not going to paint it in a hyper-realist style. I'm going to paint it in an impressionist style because it's there to give you a sense of time, a sense of place, a sense of mood, but that's it. Now, in front of that in my work is a lot of plywood that's been painted to look like mahogany. You know, and that's something I made up that might sound like it's true, and it's something true that's so weird you think I might have made it up. And yeah, the fact that you can't quite tell the difference, that's terrific. I'm fine with that. Okay, but in front of that in my work is the actual table and chairs. And I want that to be very real to you. And I want it to be so real to you, it feels like you are sitting at the table with the brother and sister as they talk to each other, and that you're sitting there close enough that you can see the changes in their expressions, you can hear the shifts in their tone as they exchange their ideas and sentiments. And I want that to be very real to you because that's where the action is. Thank you very much. And thank you, Dean. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for coming tonight, everybody. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.